Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2018. Lecture 19, delivered on April 4, 2018. The title of this lecture is The Capital Asset Pricing Model.
Today, the Capital Asset Pricing Model. Consider this the pinnacle lecture of the Introduction to Finance class. The CAPM, as we call it, is used in every finance course after the beginning one. We assume that it is ingrained in your mind if you are a finance major. And it is still to this day, although there are other models that are used for calculating discount rates and more sophisticated methods now, CAPM is still the premier, and it probably will be through at least the first half of the 21st century. To begin, just for a start off, a starter, Gesundheit, a quick survey of the markets is in order, and I'll turn on the projector here. And run through. First things first, let's look at the market just for a few minutes. Good day or bad day, sir? Good day or bad day on the markets?
Better.
Better. It's a good day. It is the euphoric high before the extraordinary drop that is going to occur inevitably. You see, we are now engaged in an almost irreversible trade war. But in the early times of a trade war, markets will get scared, but then they will realize how great it is when there is a trade war like the one that's starting. Yes?
Would you say that cryptocurrencies follow the market at all?
Yeah, they do to the extent that they are essentially almost like a harbor, a safe harbor. If you're concerned about world currencies, there you can run to the cryptos to get away from the trouble. But, of course, now governments are trying to co-opt them, regulate them, control them, get large stakes in them so they can make them do what they want. So it's difficult to say in the long run, but right now they are highly risky. There's no question, the volatility, and also the endemic problem with a cryptocurrency of theft of the currency by nefarious agents, purses being purloined and all of that. So there are those risks in there which don't happen very much with fiat currencies. But yeah, I mean, matter of fact, I'm going to focus on you. I'm going to say something here. Okay, suppose you are an American manufacturer and your product, you sell it for $10. That's the best price you can do. But there is this other country that has manufacturers that can sell it at $8, maybe because they cheat. The government subsidizes the industry participants. Maybe it's just because their labor is cheaper. But one way or the other, they sell it at less than you do. So you have a president who says, well, we're going to stop this. They cheat. So we are going to slap a 50% tariff on the import. So that will add $4 of flat cost to their import, putting it at $12. What are you going to do? You're an American manufacturer. What are you going to do?
Sell more.
Well, yes, duh. But there's something else. I have to have you start thinking like an American capitalist. Yes. You're going to jack up your price. I mean, what are your buyers going to do in the short run? Bitch? Yes. They're going to cry? Yes. They're going to call you hurtful names on Twitter? Yes. But they're still going to have to buy it. You could jack your price up even more than $1.50, and you are still below the new price of the imports. And markets are going to cheer because your profit's going to go up. Your free cash flow is going to increase. And so stocks are going to go, oh, wow, yay, wee. Until those higher prices begin to start to have their effect. The people, let's say you produce something that is used by other manufacturers. Eventually, they're going to have to buy less, because that's just basic economics. Higher price, lower quantity demanded. And then they're going to lay off workers. They're going to, and then those workers who no longer have money aren't going to go to restaurants, they're not going to go to grocery stores, and then those will start to collapse. In the other country, they're not going to sell hardly any. Their factories are going to close. Their consumer base from those factory workers' incomes will shut down. They'll drop into a recession. You'll drop into a recession. Everyone involved is going to drop into a recession. And then they're going to retaliate on you, and they're going to jack 100% on you. And then they're also going to take revenge on you, making something completely different, and on you, making something completely different. Why are they going to pick on you? Because you sell a lot of that stuff in China. So they're going to aim right at your noggins. And they're going to jack yours up, and so suddenly you're at $23 in their country, and you got nothing because you were starting to be a global exporter, and you got nothing. You're sunk. And all those other companies. And every country that engages the trade war is going to eventually, not at first, eventually start to drop into a severe recession. This was what happened in the late 1920s. The economy was falling apart, and so the president and the party in power, which was his party, said, oh, yeah, we got to see, all of our economic problems are because of these foreigners, all this foreign imports coming into our country, all these foreigners coming in and invading our workforce, all of this, communists, there's another problem. Instead of recognizing the fundamental problem that there was so much corruption, so much vile, bad business happening, so much coddling of one class of people over the larger working class, that was the real problem. But they said, we're going to solve this. We're going to slap tariffs. And everyone said, yay. Even the people who were going to be creamed by it said, yay. And so the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act was passed, and it didn't take long for the whole world to just collapse into a massive recession. The Great Depression, and it was a global depression. And we are, right now, we're in the yay phase. We are in that phase right after you take the Molly. And then, I didn't say that. Yeah, later we'll be in that phase where you wake up and say, oh, that was not a good idea at all. Boo-hoo. The bottom line, though, is that right now we're in the good phase. And so the markets will have a lot of good days. Yes?
At what point do you realize that the tariffs are a mistake?
When it's too late. I'm glad you asked that, because no one wants to see a bad effect until it slaps them in the face. And that's something that's a reality of just human nature. We learn, oh, when I was in the Army, there was this geeky kid, and he fired this rubber band at this big beefy guy over and over again. And finally, he didn't realize he was doing something stupid until the big beefy guy put him in the toilet head first. And he almost got him hauled down there. But the point there is that what usually happens is that we realize it's a mistake once everyone has already committed to the trade war. So there's no backing out until all of the heads cool. And usually it takes just getting people out of the way who were the initiators of it. Just clearing the slate and getting cooler heads in there who get together with the cooler heads in the other countries and say, let's get this, we got to stop this now. We're all in really bad shape. But in other words, what usually happens, it's only when there is enough popular or business uprising against the disaster. Once they feel it, then they start pushing new politicians in. They start telling the old politicians, you're not going to get any more money from us unless you start singing a different tune quietly. And that takes them hurting. So the financial statements have to be showing probably anywhere from 4 to 6 quarters before it really they know it's a mistake. But by then, everyone's already put the tariffs in place. The slips are in the bills of lading and all that kind of stuff. And then it starts to sink in. Oh. And then getting out of it is considerably more difficult. But yeah, it usually, this is when I tell you in general, finance and politics should stay apart. Keep them separate. Even when you know that politics is affecting financial markets, you stay away from it until you start to see something very bad happening. And then you say, we got to get you guys to calm down. And usually it takes business money, political contributions through political action committees to start getting the politicians focused. And a few people be getting kicked out of office. And that's just a reality of it. I mean, 1932 was a rout. The party in power, every one of them, senator and representative, was kicked out, I believe. The other party came into power, and it was just like a total rout. And then we could start cleaning up the mess. That didn't mean that the other party was any better, but they came in with this new idea, we've got to clean it up, and whatever they did, no matter what it was, we're going to do the opposite. Now, let me show you something interesting here. The treasuries. What I want to do is I want to get probably all of 2018 on here. Remember I told you about the yield curve. It inverts if a shorter term yield is higher than a longer term yield. Right now, only 6 basis points separate the 7-year from the 10-year. And as I told you before, that's not an inversion. The 7-year has to go above the 10-year. And it probably will float there. That is scary close. 6 basis points, but it still hasn't had a technical inversion. I looked at the intraday. You also have to look at the intraday. In other words, did it ever, during the day, did those two yields invert on each other? But it hasn't so far. And it can float there for weeks, months. You've seen it since nearly the beginning of the course. It's been floating. Sometimes it pulled more apart and then it got closer together. Right now, it's getting closer together again. And so, again, though, no recession call until you see that 7-year rate go above that 10-year rate. What I would imagine is that it'll probably be like about a 2.83 against a 2.82. Go.
So when it inverts, or if it inverts, everyone, do financial analysts call a recession, or is it the Treasury itself announced that we are in a recession?
No. Financial analysts, economists, business economists, academic economists, we simply say technical inversion has occurred. High probability of recession within 6 to 9 in 2 to 3 quarters. That's all we'll do. That's all we'll do. And it will be those who work in academia, those who work as economists and financial analysts in the public sector and the private sector, will see it. Now, what you won't see this time, hardly ever do you see government. Okay. Government economists should not be the ones who say we have a technical inversion. They should not, simply because government should shut its pie hole and not spook markets. Government does its best work when it shuts its mouth and just does its what it's supposed to do. When they start saying, if a government economist said, well, there's a technical inversion, oh, that would scare the hell out of the markets. If I say it, I might be right, I might be wrong. Who cares? I'm just some weird guy who hangs out at Illinois State University. So you don't want the government saying this. You just don't. And in this time, I don't think the government would dare to say it, fortunately. They will say all kinds of good things. It's the government's job to give, you know, happy news, rah-rah. Release the data so we can say it in the private sector, what's going on. Well, that's actually a good question to the extent that I don't want the government telling me bad news. I know it's going to tell me good news, but I don't want it to tell me bad news unless it's for my own good. But the politics of it is any government that starts saying all kinds of bad news is going to give itself a death sentence in the next election. So one way or the other. Anyway, however, the Bureau of Economic Research and the Department of Commerce will publish. This is published. This is the Department of the Treasury. They'll publish the data, but they'll let us do most of the interpretation of it, okay? Now, so there you go. Now, I want to bring up something interesting here that's important for later in this lecture. You see these rates here? They are virtually riskless. The very short-term rates they're riskless. You're going to get your money back. You're going to get this money back. There's no chance that a government debt instrument is going to default. So if you buy one of these treasury bills, you'll get it back. So that's why it's such a cheap thing. You don't get much yield because it's a very low, there's no risk. Even way out here, the only risk these have out here is that maturity premium. Other than that. Now, historically, the capital asset pricing model, which I'll show you in a while, it uses one of its parameters is the risk-free rate. Now, the risk-free rate is actually just a theoretical term. We have to make it real so that we can do real calculations. Traditionally, we use the one-year treasury as the proxy for that theoretical thing, the risk-free rate. Okay? Interestingly, I still use it. However, it's probably 5 years ago now. I was just having a discussion over dinner with a couple of financial analysts, and we were talking about the market premium over risk-free and all that kind of stuff. And they had a calculation, and I'd done one just a day or so before, and my number was different from theirs. About 200 basis points different. And I said, you guys got it wrong. I'm good. I know what I'm doing. And they said, okay, what did you do? And we showed each other how we'd calculate it. It's a very simple calculation. How can you get this wrong? They were using a 7-year for the risk-free instead of a 1-year. I said, where did you get that? And they said, well, everyone's been doing that since the 1990s, duh. And I felt like kind of an ass. I said, I haven't. They said, that's because you're stupid. And I said, why are you using a 7-year instead of a 1-year? Because a 7-year is carrying some maturity premium in it. That's a risk premium. Remember that risk premium, default premium plus maturity premium plus illiquidity premium? Well, why would you be using the 7? And they explain it like this. I buy their logic. You see, the capital asset pricing model is how we get those discount rates for future expected cash flows. Remember, I've been here a while. We'll discount these cash flows at such and such and such. I was pulling them out of thin air. Well, actually, that's CAPM. That's how you get those. And they said, how often are you going to be evaluating a project that's less than a year or a year? And I thought, well, usually, you know, it's like multi-year projects. You're discounting the future expected cash flows back. They said, that's right. So why would you be using a 1 year instead of some treasury virtually riskless that matched approximately the time horizon of your projects? And I didn't have a good answer for that. In other words, they use a 7 year because most projects are like 5 to 10 years in length. So you would probably want to use one of the input factors that was more in synchrony with the life expectancy of your projects you were discounting back. And I said, okay, that's now I learned. 7 year is oftentimes what's being used. I think I can even show you that right here in a while. Now, do I use a 7 year now? No. I'll still use that damn 1 year because that's how I've always done it. I may be wrong, but I'm consistent. Anyway. Okay, now, let me move on here just for a little bit to a couple of other things. The last lecture was about optimal portfolio construction. And I talked about the total volatility, which is often in finance measured by the standard deviation, by sigma. Now, the total volatility has two parts to it, though, as I showed you last time. There is this one part which we call the non-diversifiable risk. You cannot make that go away by putting more stocks in the portfolio. We otherwise call that sometimes the systematic risk because it is the risk that is in the system itself. Now, the other part of sigma is this diversifiable risk. We call it diversifiable because you can get rid of it by just buying more stocks. Remember I showed you those correlation coefficients? You want to make sure that they aren't well highly correlated. So, and sometimes we will call this non-systematic risk because this is not the common risk. This is the peculiar risk. This is of the stock itself. And this will go away. You cannot expect any return for this. Now, the measure that is popular for overall risk is sigma, the standard deviation. There are other metrics of risk I should point out. Interest rates are actually measures of risk. Yields, higher yield, higher risk. Coupon bonds, the coupon on a bond represents to some extent the risk of the bond. A company would have to offer a higher coupon if it's a riskier company. So there are other metrics of risk. And I want to talk a lot about risk here before I get to CAPM. But first of all, non-diversifiable risk, the risk that for which you expect a reward, the risk that remains in a well-diversified portfolio, our measure of that is beta. And I've been bringing it up all semester, and now here it is. In its fullness. You'll see in the book, they'll even show you how you calculate betas. It's way too much like work. I let supercomputers do it anymore. It's important to do it a couple of times so that you swear to heaven that you're never going to do it again. But anyway. So beta plus diversifiable risk is sigma. And interestingly, if I look at the price chart of a stock, that volatility, the ups and downs, that's sigma. In there, kind of invisible, is the part of that risk that is actually what we care about. Now, I've known a few analysts in my time. They could actually look at the whole volatility, and for some reason, they could see the beta risk in there. They could see it. And I said, how are you doing that? Well, I don't know. You just look at it. Well, no. But anyway. Okay. Optimal portfolio construction. How do you do it? Do you remember how many stocks I told you that you should have in a portfolio to get rid of about 95% of the diversifiable risk? About 30. Now, that's a lot of money if you buy a round lot of each one, and you also have to make sure that you have them in the portfolio. Their weights in the portfolio have to reflect their weights in the total portfolio overall as a market cap, as an aggregate market cap. That can be a very daunting process of creating a portfolio like that, and it would be quite costly just in terms of the commissions and also keeping an eye on the balance of the portfolio. But you can do it. Complete independence. You choose your own stocks, and then you can buy and sell them. You'll pay commission, but there you go. It's right there. However, you can do it a lot more easily and a lot more efficiently. There are two ways. Each way has an upside and a downside. The first way is to invest in ETFs, electronically traded funds. The best way to explain an ETF is to say that it is a super stock. You buy an ETF, you're buying a stock, but that stock is nothing but a portfolio of stocks. And you can buy ETFs of all kinds. I've shown you one quite a few times here, a spider. A spider is the Standard & Poor's 500. You buy the spider, you buy an ridiculously well-diversified portfolio of 500 stocks. And they are managed so that they stay in the right balance relative to each other in the portfolio. And you can buy and sell them day and night, anytime. You, sir, had a very bad pizza. And you're lying awake thinking about your portfolio. You can't sleep. It's the onions, the little hot, those little mean little green hot peppers. And you made the real ultimate mistake. You got pineapple on it. I mean, really? And you, I've got to get out of my portfolio. Or I've got to change my portfolio. You can call your broker in the middle of the night and say buy or sell an ETF, or a couple of ETFs. Now, the Standard & Poor's 500, just to give you a perspective, and my numbers might be a little bit off because the last numbers I worked with, the Standard & Poor's 500 companies represent, those 500 companies represent about 70% of the mark of the world market. I mean, that's a lot of diversification. That is 70% of the planet's market cap, possibly. That's amazing. And yet those 500 companies represent actually a tiny, tiny fraction of all of the companies on Earth. And yet, so if you buy a spider, you're buying the action on 70% of the theoretical market portfolio, right there in one ETF. So the ups, obviously, you've got massive portfolio diversification with an ETF. And you also have, but the downside is that you're going to pay a commission every time you trade. So you want to be prudent, but you're free to trade anytime, day or night, which is not true with the next one I'm going to show you. But let me do something here real quick here. I want to, I caution you about doing this, but right now I don't have my bookmarks. I've tried to import them here. I'm going to type in best ETF. That's a very bad idea because the word best, you pay Google and it will put you to the top of the search engines. But you pay a lot of money. So what you get oftentimes, you have to be careful because you're going to get clickbaits and link farms a lot. You're also going to get the big players, which might not be the best. And you want to make sure that it's not one of only one fund. I got a couple in my mind, but let me... U.S. News and World Report. Let me look here. Man, my eyes are bad today. Seriously? Where? Where? Is there a... Where?
Look at the picture.
Right. Oh, I see. Duh. Okay. Vanguard Healthcare. VHT. Now, that one's probably a relatively low beta. Let me go back. VHT. Look, you can type in... These are trading symbols. They're stocks. VHT. Okay, Vanguard. Now, these are pricey. A round lot of this is going to cost you 15 grand plus, and your commissions too. Yeah, the beta's below one. Okay, now, a couple things. It trades like a stock because it is a stock. And it has a beta. It won't have... Actually, it shouldn't even have a P.E. ratio. That's kind of weird, but one way or the other. Notice that its yield kind of sucks. I mean, compared to that beta, that's a pretty low yield. That bothers me a little bit. But the expense ratio, now this is true with both of the kinds I'm going to show you here, these ETFs and the other one. The expense ratio is how much of the money that the company makes that it pays for its executive salaries, all of its analysts, its lights, its internet, everything. This number is nice, a 0.1. I mean, I'm not opposed to anything as high as a 0.5. I saw one, interestingly enough, ISU has a couple of funds that they allow students in finance to manage. And you can take a course where you are the portfolio manager of, for example, the education fund. And you work in teams. And I was a little shocked last year when I saw, when the students showed me the current portfolio. They had a fund in there that had an expense ratio of 1.99%. I mean, I would never put my money into a fund like that, but it's not my call. But I mean, 0.1, 0.2, 0.5. This is a nice low expense ratio, although I'm really disappointed. That earnings for that beta, that's a beta that should be, I don't know, I shouldn't be bitching about that, but here. What's up next on this list? Vanguard Healthcare, that was that one, okay. Let me go for another one. What? Oh, that's way specialized. That's not going to do anything for you. Get away from me with that. God. I mean, I'm looking. Oh, there's the spider. That's the real expensive spider, though. Watch this one. XHB. Oh, that's the cheap one. That's the home builders one. I'm sorry. That's the, I thought they were doing the full $2,000 one. XHB is actually not bad, but it is a sector ETF. You would want to combine that with other ETFs. You see what I mean? That would be focused on an industry sector. Let me do one. That's got a low beta. Oh, that's taking on a butt bath. Yeah, that was one that we don't want to go into. Best my ass. Tortoise? What kind of funds are these, really? Okay. Let me try that one more time and not go. That was like, really? That was not good. ETF. Best. Okay. I want one that would be from money. Oh, that was U.S. News and World Report, wasn't it? I did. Let me try that again. See if that's a... Okay, now, ETFs can have in them bonds, stocks, or a combination of them. Small growth means that these are companies that probably don't pay a dividend. They're small cap stocks, so you're probably going to see, you expect them to grow at a faster rate because they're plowing all their money back into the company. And they're small, which means that they're riskier. I'm kind of curious. Watch. Is there some reason the internet sucks today? Vanguard International Growth Fund. What's the trading? VWIGX, VWIGX, VWIGX. Whoa! That's awful for that beta. So the ETFs, but you understand, that is one part of that is the effect of the high diversification. You're not going to get the wild ups and downs, the big wins, the big losses, although that one was pretty bad. In this case, though, it looks like this is not a very good one. Now, you're going to see the same names like Vanguard, PIMCO, T. Rowe Price, Fidelity, iShares. Here, this is the one I was looking for. I could not remember the name of it. IWG. Is that when IW... Oh, IW, there's an IWV. Okay, anyway, IWO. Now, Russell is an index tracker. Most of their funds are usually large numbers of stocks, and they're small companies. The bad part about Russell index, any Russell index, like the 2000, 3000, those... They don't weight the portfolio. It's just stocks go in, and they just take an unweighted average. So IWO, though, I'm curious about this one because that's not the Russell that I was wanting. Whoa. High beta for a low yield. So ETFs, they can have you can have fun with them, but at the same time, they're not going to be spectacular return vehicles unless you find that they have a history of a high beta and they have a history of a high yield. So you have to research them. But they do give you your portfolio diversification in spades. The next thing, mutual funds. Mutual funds are in some ways quite similar to ETFs. They are managed. They put in a lot of different things into the different things. Now, you'll have ones that are stock mutual funds. They bring in a whole pile of stocks. You can have bond mutual funds, which use only bonds. And then you can have ones that are called one-stops or blendeds. They have a combination of bonds and stocks. Now, remember what I told you before was as a general rule, you want to, in a portfolio, you want to have bonds, stocks, and cash. In other words, treasuries. And as times go from good to meh, too bad, you want to have your portfolio rebalance. So in a good market, you would want to have maybe 30% bonds, 65% stocks, and 5% in cash. You can do all of this with three mutual funds. And in a meh economy, you might want to go maybe 50%. well, no, let's do it. 45% bonds, 45% stocks, and then you put 10% into the cash. And then in a bad economy, maybe 70% bonds, maybe 15% stocks, and 15% cash. You can do that. The one stop, or the BAL, or the blendeds, try to do it all for you in a single mutual fund. That's not such a good idea. It's better if you control it yourself, just three mutual funds. Now, mutual funds, there are high load, low load, and no load. A high load fund, you have to pay a fee to enjoy, to get into it. You pay, and it can be a serious fee. With a low load, you still pay a fee, but it's a relatively modest fee. With no loads, you don't pay anything. You just get in. And I have very rarely seen a high load fund that did any better than a good no load fund. Quite honestly, I don't see any reason to join high load funds. Now, most of these, if you join on your own, they'll have a minimum entry, a minimum initial investment into them. Almost any mutual fund will. However, most companies, if they offer you a pension plan that you manage yourself, you'll have all these options for investing. And if you want to invest in mutual funds, there's no fee because you're part of that company. Like, for example, here, they offer, you can self-manage your, I can self-manage my teacher's retirement plan. And in that case, they give me all of these funds that I can invest in. Now, a family of funds are all of the funds offered by a specific house, like Vanguard. There are so many Vanguards. TIAA, PIMCO, I mean, T. Rao Price, so many that you can find something for you in almost any one of them. Now, I want to go back here and show you some mutual funds. Mutual funds that would be good. And I hope I can get a better best mutual funds 2018. Well, let's see if this is going to give me anything better. Oh, that's not what I wanted. Come on. I'm looking for, well, Kiplinger, but the balance. Maybe I can get something good there. They've actually been pretty reputable for a while. Okay. Focus. These are stock funds. Like the Vanguard, VFINX. Oops. And let's have a look at VFINX. Whoa, that's an expensive little son of a bitch. Okay. Okay, beta. Now, a lot of mutual funds, you're going to see their betas just peg the market because these are large, well-balanced, and all of that. Now you can see that, okay, Morningstar. Next thing that you want to look at. First of all, notice the expense ratio, modest, that's okay. Morningstar, which is the premier rating service, gives us 4 or 5 stars. That means that it is not, okay, 3 stars is low. 2 stars, that sucks. 1 star, OMG. Okay, so this is 4 stars. It's not great, but, you know. So now let me go and get another one here. See, notice Vanguard. These are all in a single family. Here's a Fidelity. FDFacts, let me do that one. Notice that you can do your research. They're just like stocks. I mean, what happened? Oh, I screwed up. I'm just testing you to see if you're watching. Control C. There we go. Now, don't buy a fund just because it's cheap. That's a bad idea. Okay. Oh, this one sucks. Look at that. Whoa. It's got two stars there. That's a mistake. If it's two stars, that should be below, way below average. Above average would be four stars or something like that. So there's a mistake there. Notice that the beta is below one, considerably below one, but that's actually not the worst yield in the world for something that safe. And let me do one more here. Best balance. Okay, balance, those are those ones that try to do everything for you. Hussman. Let me do Hussman because I don't know that one. So I'm just learn something. I'll learn something here. Oh, God, that's a cheapo fund. Look at that beta. If you're risk averse, there's your damn beta right there. That's the one for you. Look at that beta, 0.21. See that? What's its management fee? Morningstar. Yeah, see, there's two stars below average. That other one, there was some error in it. Okay, that gives you the idea. Here's the great thing about mutual funds. If you are within a family of mutual funds, there's no fee for switching. See, if you buy and sell stocks, you have to pay a brokerage commission. But with mutual funds, okay, Vanguard, I don't like that fund anymore. I want to get this fund over here. No charge. Except that you can do it only four times a year. Four times. So that's your downside. You don't have that freedom of buying and selling like you do with an ETF. So that's the downside of it. Yeah. Yes. Especially, I don't know how that one works, honestly, but I've known people who've tried to just jump into to funds, and they got hit the wall because they had to pay that fee to start up. They put in an order with a broker, and the broker said, well, you can't just join this fund. This fund has an entry. Or they'd say, that's not enough to start buying this fund's security. Now, one thing that I'm really glad you brought that up. You got to watch out because there are some things that are proxies for a mutual fund that you can get into for free, but they aren't the fund. So they're like a doppelganger for it, like a mirror of it, but they carry their own problems in them. One thing I want to point out here is notice that there is a full disclosure of what is in the mutual fund. Mutual funds disclose very quickly. Here's what you've got in here. Here's what we invest in right now, as far as percentage of total holdings go. Now, how do I do it? And do not take this as advice for you. I hold five mutual funds at any given time. Pure stock, mostly stock, some bonds, mostly bonds, some stock, and some bonds and some stuff that's just weird. And what I do is on a regular quarterly basis, I look at the perform. I have a huge list over here. And every quarter, I look at the two poorest performing of the mutual funds. And I kick those out and bring in the top performers from my list of mutual funds that I don't have. It's called skimming. And I do it every quarter. Some people do it every 6 months, every year. But when my window opens, I skim off the lowest performers and put in better performers. And that way, I am always in a position, and I also, my whole list, I have criteria like management fee below 0.5, half a percent. I have things like that in there too. Not just the performance of the fund, but I don't want to pay Wall Street boys more than they deserve. So there you go. That's the way I play it. And I also tend to tilt the portfolio toward the bond funds and away from the stock funds. The one fund is, of course, a pure treasury. That weird one is just treasuries of the U.S. and European. So that's my cash fund. Now, that cash fund is useful because you can bail out of bonds or stocks and have the money go into your your treasury mutual fund at any given time. It's sort of like a harbor, sort of like a way station for your money in transit from one investment to another. That's one of the best things to use the cash fund for. It's just to put your money there. If you sell out of one and you're not sure of what you want to do with it, put it in the cash fund. It's safe there because it's treasuries. Those are the three ways. Now, I'm not saying that this is something that I could ask on an exam. But it is something that I could ask on an exam. But I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that. Okay? Because if there's anything I can do for you, the theory, if you're in finance, you're going to love it, you're going to live it, you're going to enjoy it. If you're not, then there's got to be something that you can carry on with you. And this is where it gets to the point where you are actually learning how to control your own future through your own investments. And even if you have an investment advisor, a financial planner, you have enough knowledge from what I'm giving you here, at least to start to ask the right questions and to also have red flags come up if you don't think that they're doing what you learned from the best professor who ever walked the earth. And you might have a professor someday, but you have me for now. Now, I want to bring up, before I go further, I want to bring up risk again, overall risk. Because risk is, there are quite a few different types of risk. In finance, the main risk is, the risk that we are really concerned about the most is volatility of prices, volatility of returns. But there are other kinds of risk. For example, in a company, if you have variable costs present no additional risk to a company. Because your sales go up, they go up. Your variable costs of sales go down, they go down, like this. So there's no added risk from them. You have a good year, you have high variable costs. You have a bad year, you have low variable costs. They can't destroy you. Fixed costs can. They are what can wreck you. Because regardless of whether you have a good year or a bad year, you have to pay your fixed costs. Now, one fixed cost that is major, it's a business risk, is the fixed cost of your manufacturing facilities, your buildings, the people that you can't fire, the old owners, the original owners that won't let go. They are fixed. You're stuck with them. Whether you have a good year or a bad year, there they are. Now, in the long run, you might be able to modify your fixed costs. But in the short run, year, 3 years, they're just part of it. And then another kind of fixed cost is your interest expense. That's a financial risk. Because whether you have a good year or a bad year, you have to pay your interest expense. So if you have a good year, well, we got times interest earned. It's really high. A bad year, oh, my God, we can't pay our interest. Your company is gone. Right there. That's the end of it. So fixed costs are killers on you. Both the fixed costs that are business costs of your production facility and all that, and the fixed costs of your interest, which represents a financial risk to you. So those are two kinds of risk. But there are other kinds of risks that are involved too. For example, some years back, it was about 2012, something like that, the massive company called Adobe went from selling its Adobe Creative Suite to renting it. Microsoft did the same a few years later. It went from selling the Office, Microsoft selling Office, to renting it to you on a subscription basis. What they were doing was they were transferring risk from themselves to their consumers by no longer providing the shrink wrap. They no longer had a fixed cost. All they have was a variable cost. You've seen variations on that in your lifetimes. You've seen all kinds of products go to the point where they are no longer relying on big chunks of sale. They're relying on smooth, variable sales that are monthly, weekly, predictable. Have you ever noticed that you can buy a printer really cheap, and it's a good printer? You can get a Canon printer that's really nice for like $45, $65. You can get, why? Because it's not the printer that makes them the money. They'll give them away free with a computer. It's that printer ink that seems to run out after five sheets of paper that is the real cash flow. I walked into one of those pharmacy stores, CVS or Walgreens, a couple of months ago, and this lady was sitting there at this table. She wanted to give me a diabetes machine. She was going to give me one. What, lady, do I look? She was giving it free, so I took it. But they don't make their money off that fancy machine with the digital readout. They make their money off the swab pads, the lancets, the meal plans for people with diabetes. That's how they make their money. Physicians do not make their money on cures. They make their money on maintenance of illness, illness management. If they can fix you with a pill, that's not making as much money as if they can get you to be dependent upon a medicine for the rest of your life. They don't want to repair a mental disabilities, physical disabilities, as much as they want to create the cash flow. That doesn't mean they're evil. That's not conspiracy theory. That's business. That's just the way we do it. And as long as they don't kill you doing it that way. But okay, now, another aspect of risk that needs to be brought up now, and I'm going to need to have someone help me out with this. I'm going to need someone to volunteer to be a part of what's about to happen. I brought my toys. What are these?
Dragons.
Big dragons or little tiny dragons?
Little ones.
Little tiny dragons. Okay. These are little dragons. See? Oh, one of that's Sammy and Charlie. That's a two-headed dragon. Okay, now. I'm going to do something here. Is it okay if I do something? Okay, now. Okay. Dragon. Dragon. Dragons are landing all over. Attack! Attack! Roar! 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 Boom, boom, boom. See? Frequency! Now, did you get hurt? But you got hit a lot of times. I mean, it was an attack day in, day out. Yeah, roar, roar, woof, woof. You're a dragon, not a dog. Okay. Now, all those mini dragons didn't do a thing. But now suddenly, once in a generation, a giant dragon. Wait. Fire-breathing dragon. Severity. Do you see the difference between risk that has frequency and risk that has severity? It's obvious, what's going on here. There are two very different kinds of risk. Frequency and severity trade off against each other. That's why you don't have low deductibles. You have high deductibles, insurance companies, because the frequency, if they have to cover every little ding, that would kill them, but what they more likely do, that actually works, that dragon is, on your head right there. Yeah. Okay. And so you understand the two different types of risk. Frequency versus severity. Oh! I've caught my beard. Wait. Oh, that hurt. Oh. moving along. Where am I? Finally, we come tonight to the capital asset pricing model. All those discount rates I've been, well, discount this cash flow at this amount. Well, we use for the dividend cash flows back, discounting those, or the free cash flows from this project. Here's a discount rate. Here's how we get it. The discount rate for a cash flow, R sub S, equals the risk-free rate. Remember, we proxy that. I proxy it by a one-year T-bill. Others proxy it by a seven-year treasury note. Plus beta of the cash flow, the market risk of the cash flow, times the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate. The R sub M is the expected return to the market portfolio. Now, this little piece in here, this R sub M minus R sub F. Now, remember, this is an expected. We actually have a name for this piece. It's called the market premium, or the expected market premium over risk-free. It's the additional reward you get for bearing the risk of the market instead of taking a zero-risk position. You, sir, could have graduated from high school and just gone and gotten a job at Walmart. You could have done that. Make $20,000 a year. No risk. You just go to work. Or you could have gone to college, majored in finance, which you are, and come out with a salary of maybe $60,000. So the premium is the $60,000 minus the $20,000, the market minus the risk-free. That $40,000 represents the additional reward investors should expect for bearing the risk of the market instead of bearing no risk at all. You're going to get a little reward for bearing no risk, your opportunity cost of foregone consumption. But this represents, and notice that the beta is actually a magnifier and demagnifier. So a beta of 1.5 would mean that this, you should expect 1.5 times the expected market premium. A beta of 0.5 would say that you should expect half of the market premium. And we use the term market premium. I'm very sloppy about that. It's actually the expected market premium over risk-free. But a lot of us just say market premium. And they're meaning that R sub M minus R sub F. Now, the really tough one is actually, we can get betas, we can get the, whether you use a one-year treasury or a seven-year, whatever, for the R sub F. The one that is actually kind of the difficult one is R sub M, the expected return to the market portfolio. And that's a forward-looking expectation. And there are a lot of services that do this. They give their projection. Many of them have a group of experts that I'm in one group, for example. It's actually, interestingly enough, it's a market analyst group that publishes the expected market premium out of Europe, but they do it for countries like the United States and all of the European countries. And there are 70 of us in that. And they poll us every few months and say, what do you think it is right now? And we give what we think, and they take the average of them. But a lot of these are out there expected. Now, where are we right now? I mean, it's all over the board right now. The expected, you're seeing some of these estimates that are as high as 14%. You're seeing some that are as low as 2%. Where's the best one? The last time I gave one, I gave 12.1%. Right now, for R sub M, I've brought it down to, for the coming year, probably down to, I will give them, if when they poll me again, probably around 5.5%. So 5.5% for R sub M. If I use the 7-year treasury, what was that, about 2.8%? So 5.5 minus 2.8, the expected market premium over risk-free is not going to look good at all. It's going to be a very small number. So beta is going to be leveraging on a very small number. So in other words, what I'm predicting is that the stock, that discount rates overall are going to be slipping, and values of portfolios are going to be reflecting that as well. So where does that leave us? That's the capital asset pricing model. If you were thinking of getting a tattoo, you can't go wrong with CAPM. The CAPM is the basis of what we do. Now, there are new methods, but this one is going to survive for a long, long time, even in the presence of the new methods I'm teaching the advanced students and the grad students. So if you are planning to be a finance major, this is the whole part, the rest of your life. That's all I have for you tonight. I thank you.